It's no secret Americans are obsessed with dieting and constantly in search of the perfect, or at least better, body. We all know the saying, one can never be too thin, but maybe we can, and that is the subject of our interview this week with Joan Jacobs Brumberg, author of Fasting Girls, A History of Anorexia.
Your butt is wide, well mine is too. Just watch your mouth, or I'll sit on you. The word is out, better treat me right.
Weight loss machines and diet foods are among the best-selling consumer products in America. Indeed, Americans seem obsessed with the idea of losing weight. Is this obsession with dieting new? What lies behind our never-ending quest, especially among women, to lose weight, to develop what we consider to be more attractive, meaning thinner, bodies? Talking History's Dennis Mihalik is here to explore that subject with historian Joan Jacobs Brumberg.
January, among other things, is National Diet Month. Here to put the female portion of the American dieting craze in perspective is Joan Jacobs Brumberg, a professor at Cornell University who teaches in the fields of history, human development, and women's studies. Dr. Brumberg is the prize-winning author of Fasting Girls, A History of Anorexia Nervosa, a publication by Penguin Books, and The Body Project, An Intimate History of American Girls, published by Vintage. Welcome, Professor Brumberg.
Thank you for having me.
In The Body Project, you argued that a revolution has occurred in the last century in terms of the way women relate to their bodies. What changed and why?
Well, in a nutshell, women have become much more critical of their bodies, and I was able to describe this psychological shift from measuring their self-worth in terms of good works to good looks in my book, The Body Project. And I did that by looking at girls' diaries. In the 19th century, characteristically, girls are concerned about their relationship to others, their service to others, and their character. What happens in the 20th century is that all the energy seems to be focused on appearance issues. And the saddest part is that the self-critique, in other words, when something goes wrong in your life and you're upset about your friends or your family or school, whatever, it's now not about character, but about appearance. So you get lines like, my life would be perfect, you know, if only I weighed 10 pounds less, or only I had better skin, or nicer hair, or a better figure.
Mm-hmm. Now, I mean, why would such a move from character to body image take place?
Well, that's a complicated question, and it has to do with a lot of things that I talk about in the book. I mean, most people typically blame it on media. And while the media are certainly implicated, you can't blame it all on Calvin Klein. It starts earlier with different forms of media, photography, movies, advertising, all of the things that constitute modern visual culture. But it also has to do, you know, with changes in hygiene and health, greater attention to cleanliness issues in the body, the investment of middle-class parents in their daughter's skin, the emergence of dermatology, the investment of parents in their kids' teeth, orthodonture, you can see where I'm going. Mm-hmm. That the medicalization of life in the United States also has been a contributing factor to the notion of an ideal body, and girls seem to have internalized this more in a visual culture than they did for back in the 19th century, when many of them didn't even have mirrors, for example, in their homes. So the introduction of new technologies, such as the bathroom mirror, electric lights, and running water, just think about the modern bathroom and how important it is to this appearance issue. And then the introduction of the domestic bathroom scale after World War II. I mean, until that time, most women were going to drugstores or to gymnasiums to weigh themselves.
Mm-hmm. Now, you say an ideal body. I mean, has the image of an ideal female body changed over time?
Oh, yeah, definitely. It's always changing. And you know, there is a neat chronology that suggests, well, in the Victorian period, women wanted a wasp, tiny waist, and an ample bosom and hips, and the ample bosom and hips was a sign that you weren't sick with one of the wasting diseases that were that terrorized people in the 19th century. By the early 19-teens and the 1920s, culture is changing, so is the ideal, a flatter bosom, a more youthful, as opposed to matronly look. More and more cultural attention is given to legs as the skirts get shorter. But as the shirts get more minimal too, we begin to see more attention to the hairless ideal. And you get the first ads for depilatories to remove underarm hair and also leg hair as silk stockings come in. By the 1950s, full bosom, much like the Madonna ideal, pointed, cone-shaped bras and girdles, even for young women. And then by the 1960s, you know, the blue jeaning revolution changes all that and shifts our eye and our interest to the pelvis and buttocks and thighs, and that's when you begin to see in girls' diaries talk about thunder thighs. I would say that at the end of the century, the 1980s and 1990s, now, the emphasis is on a very, very slim, if not emaciated, female body, but it also must be toned, and there must be some musculature, especially in the upper arms, and you're supposed to have an absolutely flat pelvis as well, and that should be manicured. By that I mean the bikini line area must be hairless. And so what's happened now is that the pressure is on the upper and the lower body in terms of the ideal. So that's one of the interesting things, is what body parts are emphasized in the aesthetic or the ideal of different historical eras.
Mm-hmm. So that, like today, we see a lot of emphasis put on women working out and all these workout tapes that are sold. When did, as opposed to working out, when did dieting come into fashion?
Well, dieting is really, modern dieting as we know it, a female activity, not a male activity, and not just for health, but primarily for beauty, right? That kind of dieting, beauty-centered by women, is really a feature of, begins to be a feature of American culture in the 1920s. And a lot of that has to do with the fact that the calorie is invented, if you will, in the early part of the 20th century. I mean, you can't count calories until you know what a calorie is, until that concept is available. It spread through a lot of the columns by beauty editors in magazines and newspapers in the 20s. It fits with the streamlining of fashion in the 20s, you know, the move to the chemise dress, shorter, showing more flesh. And it seems to me, from what I can, what I've uncovered in my research, is that a lot of adolescent girls caught on to, adolescent and young adults, excuse me, girls caught on to this idea of dieting and calorie counting, and they actually taught it to their mothers, who for the first time, that was the first generation really of American matrons, married women, I'd say 40 plus, who started to be concerned about being stout, being too stout, and you see that the fashion industry begins to say to them, look, here is a style that will make you appear slim and not stout, not too robust. Mm-hmm. So it's the 1920s, really. And that, you know, that fits with other things that are going on, too, in movies and department stores, and the insurance industry has begun to connect overweight to mortality, and pediatricians are issuing more and more height and weight charts. So the 20s are really a critical decade in terms of the history of modern dieting.
Mm-hmm. And in the 20s, you say, medicine, is this when they came up with these standardized weight charts?
That's when they really become, you know, I would say more commonplace, yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, I mean, what's the relationship between a dieting for body image and anorexia?
Well, that's a good question. Today, the relationship seems to be quite clear because the modern ideal body configuration, which is extremely thin, seems to be implicated in the behavior of most anorexic girls. Most of them say, "I am too fat." Now, what's interesting, though, is that anorexia nervosa emerged as a modern disease entity in the 1870s, long before Twiggy or Kate Moss. So, you know, you have to go back and look at the context of anorexia nervosa in the 19th century to try to understand what was going on. Although I have never seen the diary of a 19th century anorexic girl that says, "I did not eat because," so of course I am speculating based on what I know about the culture and what the medical case records say. I think it would be fair to say that girls, for Victorian girls, food and eating also had a negative meaning. The meaning, though, was different than today. Today, girls don't want to eat or be fat because they think that that's not sexy. In the 19th century, many girls didn't want to eat. They didn't want to eat meat, and they didn't want to eat much because they wanted to disassociate themselves from food and eating, which they considered an emblem of their carnality and lack of control and a lack of self-restraint. You follow what I'm saying? They they wanted to be ascetic. They wanted to appear to not have any earthly fleshy carnal needs, and they also didn't want to be heavy or robust for class reasons. They didn't want to appear to look like working class girls. They didn't want to look like a milkmaid anymore. So there's a whole configuration of ideas about food, eating, body, and social class that existed in the 19th century that probably fueled anorexia nervosa in that era. They're somewhat different than today.
Mm-hmm. Now, as you mentioned, the difference between a middle-class person and a milkmaid, are women of all classes and, say, all cultures, African-Americans or Europeans and Latin Americans, I mean, are they in a similar dieting craze, and do they have a similar crisis with anorexia?
Well, it's a very good question. There are some important class and ethnic differences. The literature to date seems to suggest that African-American women are less vulnerable to developing eating disorders because they tend to have a more fluid, more accepting notion of what makes for female beauty. The problem with some of that research is that it doesn't control for social class differences. It also seems that as different groups kind of move up in the hierarchy of social classes, in other words, as they move out of the working class into the middle and upper middle classes, that their daughters become more vulnerable or more at risk for anorexia nervosa. This was true of American Jews. It appears to be true of African Americans. It appears to be true of Asian Americans. So that's the answer for the U.S., that social class really trumps race in terms of what's salient. And the more affluent you are, the more likely you are to develop eating disorders. Although, I should say that this is much more true of anorexia nervosa than bulimia. Bulimia seems to be more democratic, if you will, with a small d. I don't mean the party. The other thing that's interesting is that in other countries, yeah, there is quite a bit of anorexia nervosa these days. It's new. My books have been translated into Japanese, which I find really interesting, and German, so that tells you something about where these things are occurring. It's also true in Rio, in Brazil. I think the answer to that question is that wherever there are westernizing influences and a certain kind of idealized beauty, probably perpetuated through American television and movies, you know, and MTV, stuff like that, plus a certain level of affluence and a certain kind of intensive family life, you know, close parenting, not a lot of children, you're going to see anorexia nervosa.
Mm-hmm. Now, earlier, you dismissed males in this dieting and anorexia. I mean, is there a male counterpart? Well, in your definition, you said that you were defining
female dieting.
Female dieting, yes. Is there a male counterpart to this?
Well, there is in the sense, there are two ways to answer that. I think one is that there are some boys and men who get into steroid abuse, certainly, right?
Mm-hmm.
Kind of pumping up, who get into exercise addiction. Some people see that as a male counterpart in terms of this preoccupation with bodily perfection. But, you know, the second part of an answer to your question about gender difference is that at the end of the 20th century, it seems to me that both men and women alike, even middle-aged people like me, have somehow in this culture come to believe that the body is perfectible. And that's reflected in our behaviors, much of it devoted to wellness, you know, to healthful activities, walking and exercise and exercise of all kinds and nutritional diets. But we are a culture that believes that the body is perfectible, male and female alike, and so we're beginning to see more and more pressure on young boys for them, too, to have perfect bodies. Having said that there are more male cases of eating disorders now than there were 20 years ago, still this is disproportionately a behavior, a syndrome, a disorder, a disease associated with women and girls.
Okay. Well, that's all the time we have. I want to thank our guest, Professor Joan Jacobs-Brumberg, author of Fasting Girls and The Body Project, for this very interesting discussion.